Now, this is the second of two lectures, and there are some who could come only for the first one, and a few who are here only for the second one. So I want to give the second one, tie back just a bit to the first one, so that we may maintain a little bit of continuity and carry it forward just a bit. After these lectures, as I indicated, there'd be a third lecture on living at the bottom of a well. That is the moving away from the Christian axioms and their implicates by gradually committing mayhem on one or another of these core doctrines until ultimately we come down to the contemporary scene, which I depict in the twilight of a great civilization, in which secular humanism, which holds that the whole of reality is reducible to impersonal processes and events. That means there is no supernatural, everything is nature in some form. And that all moral distinctions are relative and culture conditioned. All principles of philosophy, of ethics, of theology are revisable. And that everything is time-bound, so that man, like the animals, is headed for the grave as his final destiny. That this secular humanism, which is very, very pervasive now in the West, but which clings to a social agenda of ethics. That is, it really has made a cause célèbre of human rights and of ecological sensitivity and opposition to racial discrimination, racial equality, its work. What has happened most recently in the last 5 or 6 years is that the more radical students in the some of the American universities have taken the initiative and said to the professors, we agree with you that there's no supernatural. We agree with you that everything is time-bound. We agree with you that all moral imperatives and philosophical tenets, theological principles, are culture conditioned and subject to change. But how then do you insist on this social agenda? How can you attach any ethical finality to these principles? And they say, go all the way, that it is self-interest that is really the ultimate determinant. That's the turn that I indicate in Twilight of a Great Civilization, the move down to neo-paganism. Though I do emphasize that it is twilight and not yet midnight. A twilight, said Hegel, is when the owl of Minerva flees. That is, darkness takes over and chaos begins to prevail. It gets increasingly difficult to make any significant distinctions. So that's the area in which we live. And on the one hand, if I were preaching to you about the need for Christian involvement and so on, that's the theme that I pursue. But on the other hand, I'm also taking a look at the long-range structures of evangelical theology and what I think is an adequate basis on which to pursue evangelical theology in a time when I think increasingly empiricism is running out of cash and is proving an unlikely and unpromising basis in which to elaborate, especially a theology that claims to be evangelical. So now the axioms of biblical theism. Every theology, every philosophy, every science has a starting point. Euclid derived the whole science of geometry from basic axioms. All theological and philosophical systems have governing axioms. That is, axioms are, by the nature of the case, beyond proof. Even logic rests on the law of contradiction. One must assume it to deny it. All science also has presuppositions. And so too philosophy, whether it is naturalistic or Kantian or positivistic, only that is sensually verifiable, can be meaningful or true. Now, since the secular philosophers cannot justify their governing premises, Christians need not hesitate to insist that Christian axioms are at least as legitimate as theirs. Christian axioms do not differ from other axioms in being a priori. All axioms are a priori. Christians need not bend their views to alien a priori's. They're as entitled as others to their starting point. There's no need to engage in a common search with atheists or agnostics or others for philosophical truth. The secular philosopher often insists that we look critically at all beliefs, but he then takes his own a priori's for granted and demands that others abandon theirs and subscribe to his. A Christian has a right and duty to state his case on its own terms. So we do well to begin with what we as Christians know, and then to systematize and deepen and apply our pre-philosophical convictions. Even empirical scientists postulate conceptual models. The laws of nature and causality are more theoretical than empirically verifiable. As you know, science has pretty well abandoned the idea of causality in nature as an explanatory principle, and speaks more modestly, because causality is not empirically observable at any rate, speaks more modestly of predictable sequences in causality. But the laws of nature and causality are more theoretical than empirically verifiable. The current naturalistic view considers nature and history a flux, a chaos that man himself orders. The humanist view is that nature and history have no intrinsic purpose or order, but that man himself superimposes upon nature and history whatever pattern they bear. It is as legitimate for a theist to hold that God is the cause, perhaps the final cause, rather than the other types of causality. It's as legitimate for a theist to hold that God is the cause of the universe as it is for a scientist to hold that God is the cause of the universe. The basic axioms of Christianity are two. The ontological axiom, the Christian ontological axiom, is the living God. Triune God, if you wish, but at any rate, the living God. And the basic epistemological axiom is divine revelation. In recent years, there has been increasing talk of theological explanatory models, akin to the scientific theoretical models. Ian Barber said that theoretical models do not represent reality literally. In science. But the distinction is really artificial. No laws of science are fixed and final. So all experimental science is operational. It tells us how nature works. But what it says about nature is revisable. So when he says that theoretical models do not represent reality literally, that all science is that way. No science represents reality, literally. But what then of the truth of theological postulations? Secular philosophers are more prone to question theological credibility than scientific credibility. They're inclined to say that theology is creative or mythical, and that it offers no decisive explanation. Yet evangelical Christianity does not affirm its axioms simply as a provisional theoretical approach, or postulate them only for their utility. But it affirms literal and factual truth about the nature of things. It insists that revelation is not an achievement of philosophical reasoning. Without revelation, we wouldn't know what revelation is. The Enlightenment promoted human reason by stifling divine revelation, and as a result, it suffocated both revelation and reason. The question of the relations of reason and revelation are being raised anew, especially by Calvinist scholars today, and most of all by Alvin Plantinga, who recently gave the Gifford Lectures a couple of years ago, which are soon to be in print. To some extent by Nick Walterstorff, too. From Christianity's foundational statements, James Orr, in his Christian View of God and the World, shortly before the turn of the century, derived all the essential Christian postulates: a supernatural sovereign who decreed the universe and created ex nihilo, man's divine image and stewardship, man's violated relationship and God's offer of salvation, divine incarnation, the role of the church, over which the crucified and risen Jesus is the exalted Lord and head, and man's dual destiny. Secular philosophers project rival principles at odds with each other. Empiricists exalt observation and experience over philosophical reasoning, but they are at odds with each other. Some hail the scientific method of sense observation and verification as definitive of reality. Hence, they reject the supernatural, because it cannot be sensually perceived. Others widen the conception of experience beyond sensate knowledge, to include direct relations to other selves and to God. We experience other selves and we experience God. Mystics say God is beyond truth and error, good and evil. So experience is clearly not self-interpreting or self-authenticating. Some say religious experience is inexpressible in language. But if that's the case, nobody else can be urged to have the same experience that we have. Propositional expressibility is a precondition for evaluating any system. In any case, experience is incomplete and subject to correction. Moreover, some religions, for example, Judaism and Christianity, hold that God does not relate himself in the same way to all human beings. Earlier empiricists held that explanatory hypotheses rise from accumulated experiential data and inductive principles, which further experience verifies. But we do not directly experience the physical world. Our experiential data consists of sensations and neurological data. The cause of these sensations was held to be the physical world. But so too, other selves, human and divine, were regarded as inferences from our conscious experiences. But the interpretation added qualities that were not immediately observed, not immediately sensually perceived. God's existence was thought to be demonstrated by empirical data, so-called proofs of God. Hume objected that the empirical argument assumes origination by creation and ignores evil, and hence leads at best to a finite God. We grasp sense data through an interpretive framework of beliefs. Although philosophers define experience divergently, scientific empiricism, laboratory observation, permits no verdict on the metaphysical and moral worlds. Basic beliefs are not empirically inferred. We screen experiential data through cognitive lenses. All confirmation and disconfirmation takes place within a background picture. The decisive role of presuppositions is increasingly apparent to 20th century scholarship. Leslie Newbegin says rightly, "I believe in order to understand is fundamental to science. Theoretical constructs like Big Bang, a magnetic field, subatomic particles derive not from experimental induction, but from intuition and imagination." Stephen Toulmin says that empirical investigation has no direction without a pre-existing body of ideas. These control ideas sometimes gain currency even before impressive verification. For example, black holes, as well as subatomic particles. Physicists speak of seeing subatomic particles, but what they really see is hydrogen bubbles. They infer protons or neutrons, leptons, photons, or quarks to explain the behavior they observe. Many physicists hold electrons are abstractions, postulates to facilitate interpretation. Scientific theories are now often viewed as aesthetic constructs and are even given more weight than is given to laboratory support. As long as a theory is not falsified and has some experimental support. Richard Morris, in the book Dismantling the Universe, writes, "Of mesons and quarks and gluons as dreams, and says they almost certainly do not exist." But science creates pictures so logically elegant, he says, that we cannot doubt that they are true. Some Christian scholars invoke this postulational approach to attach a high probability claim to Christian truth. Edward John Carnell, for example, said that Christianity accounts with greater consistency and coherence than its rivals for the world and for experience. But David Wolfe warns that Christian theism is highly vulnerable if, like scientific postulates, it is held to be more or less probable on the basis of progressive verification. I mean, you can report maybe this week that the resurrection is 95% sure. Maybe the week after next you can say 96%. Christian belief does not find its warrant, again, in a 72% probability that the creedal affirmations are true. Wolff concedes that complete verification is impossible, at least before the eschatological end time. But he also stresses Karl Popper's argument that decisive disconfirmation is equally impossible. What constitutes a natural fact or historical event is not determined independently of the interpreter's stance. We locate nebulous data claims on a metaphysical map. We had a good reminder of that in the States. What really happened in the assassination of John F. Kennedy? Lyndon Johnson was persuaded that the communists had a hand in it. When we were in South Africa the day in Johannesburg, when we turned on the radios, we did, when the alarm clock rang at 6 in the morning and BBC News came on and said, President John F. Kennedy has been assassinated. It is thought that right-wing elements in the United States were involved. Something like that. Then the BBC won. So then BBC thought that there was the right wing. Lyndon Johnson thought it was the left wing. We had an investigation conducted at the behest of the Supreme Court, and so on. And there are still doubts about what happened in the Kennedy assassination. And the way one comes down in the interpretation depends upon the metaphysical map with which one approaches the data. The Protestant reformers held that belief in God is rational and proper without philosophical argumentation. Plantinga emphasizes that such belief was not therefore groundless and arbitrary, but nonetheless rationally justifiable. The reformers stressed as a given God's self-revelation and the constitution of human nature with the truth of God's existence. They didn't arrive at that conviction by empirical argumentation, but rather insisted that this is a given. Now, a skeptic may take issue, but that does not alter the reformers' insistence that belief in God is epistemically grounded and is basic to all other truth claims. For example, the existence of the world and of other selves. They held that empirical argument is unnecessary to establish the existence of God, the existence of the world, and the existence of other selves. The crucial issue is not whether it is right and reasonable to believe contrary to evidence. Because I said these beliefs are pre-philosophical. The crucial issue is not whether it is right to believe contrary to evidence, but just what evidence is appropriate. Should we read only atheists or technical professional philosophers or the Bible also and study the life of Jesus? What is the evidence that's appropriate? Positivism held that unobservables must be defined in terms of observables, the principle that led to the discrediting of positivism. Positivism itself is a principle. Some scientists justified non-observables in terms of anticipated behavior or of aesthetics. Some analytic philosophers, among them Plantinga in the States, Peter Gates, Richard Swinburne in England, insist that Christianity's central affirmations are logically coherent and rationally defensible. Since logical inconsistency invalidates any syllogism, it serves as a negative test of truth. John W. Montgomery, who is one of the more vigorous empiricists or evidentialists in the States, champions empirical verification rather than logical consistency. He warns, we may always still discover a more consistent system than Christianity. Presuppositionalists therefore face an endless task if they go this way. Montgomery champions empirical verification rather than logical consistency. He warns that we may always still discover a more consistent system than Christianity. So the presuppositionalists face an endless task if they go the way of regarding logical consistency is a negative test of truth. Now, to be sure, we can only grapple known systems. And we need not invent imaginative ones. If Montgomery knows a more consistent system, he ought to adduce it. We should evaluate the captivating options that attract the masses in our time. But if Christianity is true, no system will or can be more comprehensively consistent. There may be consistent subsystems. For example, geometry is a subsystem in terms of worldly view. And that might be a consistent subsystem. But these are all partial. While logic prevails, a consistent system cannot be falsified. And if Christianity is true, no system will or can be more comprehensively consistent. Empirical theologians say that in contrast to presuppositional theologians, they appeal not to opinions but to facts. An orderly universe and Christ's resurrection, they argue, prove God's existence. Now, this argument that the resurrection of Christ proves God's existence, or that the design of the universe proves the existence of God, that stirs a believer's heart. No question about that. Even Kant spoke of the starry heavens above and their impression upon him. But apart from revelation, and simply by an appeal to empirical considerations, can one really arrive at the view that after crucifixion, Jesus was raised never to die again, or as the first fruits of a future general resurrection? How are you going to demonstrate that merely by empirical observation? Empiricists themselves are covertly laden with presuppositions of their own. Many of those presuppositions are parasitic on the Judeo-Christian heritage. The time is linear rather than circular or cyclical, That there is that a universal order prevails. That the senses provide reliable evidence. I say, they are covertly laden with presuppositions of their own. R.C. Sproul and John Gerstner and Art Lindsley in a recent book decry presuppositionalists as fideistic. I have argued that this is unfair to presuppositionalists who insist strenuously on a principle of verification and a test of truth. The empiricists do not distinguish types of evidence. They gloss over presuppositions of their own. For example, the law of non-contradiction, the validity of causality, the basic reality, the basic reliability of sense perception. Their very premises are questioned by other empiricists. Presuppositions decisively influence one's interpretation of the data. When Darwin still believed in divine creation, he said that the grandeur of the Brazilian forest reinforced his firm conviction of creation. But later, he said that the grandest scenes would evoke no such conviction. Owen Gingrich at Harvard says that the argument from design won't convert a skeptic to theism, but to begin with God in perceiving the universe evokes a conviction that it everywhere borders on the miraculous. The presupposition with which one approaches the data makes the difference. Evangelicals, naturalists, process philosophers do not see the same facts. Even empiricist explanations rely more on creative postulation than on strict induction. There is metaphysical loading. Whether it is due to intuition or imagination or tradition or culture or revelation. Interpretative presuppositions are now widely regarded as merely subjective or culture conditioned. Now, if so, then if all presuppositions are simply culture conditioned and subjective, then relativism is unavoidable. But the dogmatic relativist seeks to exclude his own dogma from the net. So is self-contradictory. The existence of rival worldviews does not argue for the truth of none. We may show that almost all views are internally contradictory or reductionist without concluding that none is objectively true. But intellectual justification is crucial if fideism is to be avoided. Without it, we and others may abandon a worldview that is true. Most people will reject what seems logically contradictory. Sometimes an apparently invalid theory may be restated in a logically consistent way. But logical consistency is, as we have indicated, only a negative test of truth. Invalid premises cannot be true. But consistency does not establish truth. We can elaborate consistent systems on the basis of rival a priori. For example, naturalistic evolution can elaborate a consistent system on its own premise that everything is a more complex development of an evolutionary matrix. And when it runs into a problem, the answer will be, give us enough time. What has explained everything else will explain this also. But in no case can a consistent system be arrived at empirically. An empirical explanation always has to be open to tomorrow. There may also be undetected inconsistencies. Secular axioms sooner or later betray their inability to account for the data. I don't know whether you've ever seen Gordon Clark's work on Thales to Dewey. There is a competent American evangelical philosopher, recently deceased, who spanned the history of Western philosophy from Thales to Dewey, and hundreds of times in that volume, the question of logical consistency on the part of the secular philosophers is raised. Discovery of, or exposure of, the logical inconsistencies of the prominent philosophers does not of itself prove the Christian revelation to be true. In fact, demonstrative proof of any metaphysical overview is presently impossible. You can't give a demonstrative proof of its truth before the logical end time. A demonstrative proof. Clark, in his book, A Christian View of Men and Things, notes the weaknesses of contemporary philosophies alongside the Christian postulates. But there can be only one comprehensive system of truth. If the true system is comprehensive, every false system will contain contradictions. Some scholars argue for coherence as a test rather than logical consistency as a negative test. But the philosophers have disagreed. They disagree among themselves as to what constitutes coherence. It's far less difficult to agree on what constitutes an invalid syllogism than what constitutes unacceptable or acceptable coherence. Coherence is always jeopardized if it is accommodated to illogic. Some critics charge that the Christian system is circular, because it sets out with what they insist needs to be proved. But that would exclude all systems. No system exists without basic axioms. All arguments involve circularity. A comprehensive universe of discourse is the mark of a logically consistent system. Every consistent system is complete and self-contained, apart from possible illogical departures from its starting point. Yet the truth of the Christian system is, in important respects, evident even to the outsider. Because of the imago Dei, no two persons have globally divergent sets of beliefs. Because of the imago Dei, no two persons have globally divergent sets of beliefs. The Christian worldview is not merely an optional theoretical system, but it involves a universally shared pre-scientific understanding of reality, the existence of God, of other selves, and of the world. I am not arguing that all belief systems contain components of truth. I'm not arguing that there's some truth in Buddhism as a religion and some truth in Platonism as a philosophy or Augustinianism. I'm not arguing that all belief systems contain components of truth. The overarching framework is decisive for the meaning of particulars. For example, Plato speaks of spirit, the ultimate world of spirit, world of the eternal ideas. Jesus said God is spirit. And Hegel spoke much of the absolute as spirit. But by no means do they mean the same thing. Hegel's spirit is an absolute of which embraces all of us as parts. He was essentially a pantheist. They both speak of spirit. They might all say in somewhere in their exposition, God is spirit, but hardly mean the same thing. The overarching framework is decisive for the meaning of the particulars. Secular views cannot consistently account for existence and meaning. Take Darwinism. It says that nature and logic are changing emergence. And yet it considers Darwinism a permanently valid theory. It would be interesting if logic is to change, to get some suggestion as to what the new logic would be like. Humanism says that truth and ethics are culture conditioned, yet it affirms the universal dignity and rights of man. I say the secular views cannot consistently account for existence and meaning. Behaviorism says human thought and life is chemically determined, yet its theory is considered transcendently explanatory. The speculative conceptual systems are plagued by inconsistencies. Christianity holds that our primal experience is structured on God the Creator, who is the infinite mind, himself the source of truth. Man is a bearer of the Imago Dei, and the capacity for truth and moral distinctions has always traditionally been considered a central feature of the Imago Dei. That the Holy Spirit, the Spirit of truth, uses truth to persuade and gives faith. That the Logos is the source and support of all created existence. That the mind of God constitutes and expresses the very nature of reality. And that all the Christian postulates flow from God in his self-revelation. Now I go on in the lectures beyond these initial ones on the presuppositions and the axioms of biblical theism to a further lecture that I do not give here but elsewhere. On living at the bottom of a well, as I indicated, where the Christian core beliefs are progressively moderated, dismissed, and that even movements that place themselves at first unwittingly and then intentionally over against Christianity, retain from the past elements that they seem to be unaware of. And that the next movement of philosophy, while this may not be an undulation that is cyclical in that predictable sense, nevertheless there is a progressive deterioration. And argue that today Western culture moves along with the erosion of humanism from secular humanism, and with the rise of even the drug culture, which is reaching for an arena of transcendence that is not definable in terms of propositional revelation, but rather which leaps over the distinctions of rationality and of morality into some sort of a psychic chemical orgasm, as it were, that widens self-consciousness. And the rise of deconstructionist philosophy, which wants to dismiss every view of an objective God, all the way from Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, the Middle Ages, the early modern philosophers, and right through the contemporaries, and go behind them to the class, to the pre-classic Greek materialists and a thoroughgoing naturalism. That with that, we are living at the bottom of the well.